Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents The First Soldier, Hitler as Military Leader, by Stephen Fritz, narrated by P.J. Oakland. I now wish to be nothing other than the first soldier of the German Reich. Therefore, I have put on that tunic which has always been the most holy and dear to me. I shall not take it off again until victory is ours, or I shall not live to see the day. Adolf Hitler, speech of 1 September 1939, announcing war with Poland. Preface. Life is normally characterized by irony, paradox, ambiguity, and ambivalence. But Adolf Hitler saw it with a startling and frightening clarity. Beginning early in his career as an orator and political rabble-rouser, he habitually used history as an explanation and justification for his actions. He had indeed read a great deal of history, and was as confident in treating his public audiences to lengthy expositions as he was in repeatedly invoking historical analogies in talks with his generals. In many respects, then, his ideas and actions were largely derivative and rarely original. He often acted, or tried to act, as others had, but more often than not failed to consider the respective historical contexts. To a considerable extent, based as it was on his reading of history, he valued his own understanding of Germany's historical destiny more than the stability and economic well-being of the country. Moreover, he had the ability to discern what many Germans wanted, to describe a vision of the future that was his, but persuade them it was theirs as well. Although certainly stylized, he also created an image of himself, one he came to believe was real, as a leader with a historic mission, one consumed by the task of restoring the broken body of Germany. Like Napoleon, he had a sense that he was acting out history in deciding the fate of his people. His reading of past events had convinced Hitler that Germany had been cheated by history. The horribly destructive 30 Years' War, fought in German lands, but for largely non-German reasons by primarily non-German armies, had devastated the country and, Hitler believed, deprived it of its rightful dominant position in Europe and the world. This role had then been usurped by France and Britain, which proceeded over the following centuries to keep Germany weak and divided. The First World War, to Hitler, had been an attempt to redress this mistake. But Germany failed because its leaders lacked a clear notion of what they were trying to achieve. Ideas matter, and for good, or mostly ill, Hitler then developed a set of ideas based on his own and Germany's ordeal of the Great War. The experience of national humiliation in 1918 in particular was deeply ingrained in the minds of Hitler and the German people. He was not alone in believing that their past had been taken from them, that their struggle and sacrifices had been rendered meaningless. If nothing of value had been achieved by the enormous loss of life in the Great War, then what had been the point? This nihilistic thought tormented Hitler in the days and months following Germany's defeat. In his early speeches, and then in his later actions, he moved to restore meaning to a national life he thought scarred by the haunting fear that it had all been in vain. His goal was thus not merely to revise the Versailles settlement, but to expunge the national shame, and this required war. Once in power, Hitler set about implementing his ideas, and within his frame of reference, made decisions that were logical and rational, or at least not irrational, in the sense that they were taken with a calculated consideration of external circumstances, and behind them there existed a logically coherent pattern. It is also critical to understand the importance, for Hitler, of hatred, as well as his obsessive need for revenge against those groups and countries that had ruined Germany. Although there would have to be another war, this was not to be just any war, but a conflict that would punish those held responsible for Germany's humiliation, as well as ensure that such a national disgrace did not happen again in the future. The Second World War, then, would be a radically transformative war, the next and final attempt to set things right. Not for nothing did Hitler think and speak in apocalyptic terms. Germany, he insisted, faced one of two options: world power or destruction. To Hitler, it would be nothing less than a war for survival, one in which Germany's mortal enemies had to be defeated and the nation given the means to exist. He chronically thought in terms of grand schemes, but this vision was a sort of apocalyptic utopianism in which everything was black and white. He saw himself and his nation as being in a struggle for its very survival, and he was certain that defeat meant the end of Germany. The searing experience of the Allied hunger blockade of the First World War had convinced him of that. He had, he thought, drawn the proper lesson. In the next war, it would be others who starved. A lesson that eventually doomed millions to death. His was an all-or-nothing, social Darwinist view, but it was also fueled by his reading of history. After all, he believed the Roman Empire had expanded, survived, and thrived because it had annihilated those who opposed it. In the liberal imagination, evil is a failure of reason, so the tendency is to see Hitler as irrational. Hitler, though, tended to think and operate according to his own logic, instinct, and intuition. His very dynamism and pernicious creative mind, fashioning a compelling narrative from history that was difficult to refute. The problem, then, lies in the failure to understand that reason, as such, is not necessarily the key focus of political loyalty or action, and that it provides scant emotional comfort in times of crisis. Far more than an appeal to reason, nationalism or group or ethnic loyalties have allowed states to mobilize and demand sacrifices from citizens, and then to construct stirring accounts of suffering and martyrdom. Sacrifice, in particular, entails a shared sacred experience that provides collective meaning, something that the notion of progress struggles to comprehend. Hitler's lack of humanity thus might be seen as being driven by his larger historical concerns: avenging the alleged insults done to Germany, and pursuing its proper hegemonic status in order to restore meaning to history. Hitler thus raised his political ideological goal to one of existential significance. In willing the ends, though, one also has to possess the means to achieve them. And in this, Hitler clearly understood Germany to be deficient. It had to gain Lebensraum, living space, to secure its future existence. But in the present, it lacked the economic resources to do so. He hoped to solve this conundrum through political-military cooperation in a war that, since it was one waged for his nation's very existence, would be absolute and allow for no compromise. The very harshness of the war that Hitler unleashed, in turn, affected both his decisions and the determination of his enemies to fight on. Karl von Clausewitz warned about mistaking one type of conflict for another, but, if anything, it was Hitler's generals who fell victim to this fallacy, for he himself had a clear awareness of the nature of his war, what it was meant to accomplish, and by what means. He also came to understand better than his generals that his war would so harden attitudes that his opponents would be little inclined to negotiation or compromise. For them as well, it would be all or nothing. Hitler generally had a sound grasp of strategic and economic realities through the first half of the war. Although he never had a clear understanding of how to convince the British, or was it Churchill, to abandon the conflict, a fact that increased the time pressure he faced. Despite claims to the contrary in their memoirs, his generals were no better either as strategists or, arguably, even in operational conceptions. To a considerable extent, he also deferred to his commanders and military advisors, as long as they proved successful. Hitler tended to be wary of any plan that did not originate with him, but at least in the beginning it was possible to reason with him. The trick, though, was to carefully pick when and where to do it. It was always better to pose alternatives indirectly, to allow him an avenue of escape in any dispute, and to be the last one to speak with him. Even when he issued a seemingly final military pronouncement, he not infrequently bowed to the wishes of his generals if they provided a convincing explanation for their course of action. Hitler did indeed come to distrust his generals, whom he regarded as cautious, conservative, and forming a secretive clique, and often for good reason. General Franz Halder, especially, persistently circumvented Hitler's wishes. As Führer and Feldherr, commander-in-chief, Hitler demanded that his power be respected. But, perhaps equally important, he wanted to be told that he was right. When things went wrong, he was not in error. Others had made mistakes or had deceived him with false information. Still, his generals commonly expressed admiration for his political skills and support for his expansionist goals. Hitler began to founder only when the war turned against Germany, when he believed his military leaders had failed, or were deliberately obstructionist, when he became increasingly impatient at what he saw as a rapidly closing strategic window, and thus when he tried to micromanage all affairs. Having made such vast territorial gains, and been tantalizingly close to achieving the Lebensraum that was for him the goal of the war, he could not envision giving any of it back voluntarily. From at least the second half of 1942, he immersed himself in the details of the war, an enormous effort that affected him in terms of both his health and his ability, or willingness, to see the larger picture. It was as if the very act of immersion in details shielded him from having to admit the grim strategic truth. Occasionally this broke through, then he would flee back into the realm of details. This perhaps also accounted for his characteristic leadership style, which seemed to consist of equal parts of indecision and stubbornness. He undoubtedly possessed a powerful force of will, which, of course, is not to be confused with wisdom. In the later stages of the war, too, there was the question of his increasing use of drugs such as pervitin, a methamphetamine, which probably resulted in overstimulation and heightened self-confidence, as well as anxiety and paranoia, and the likelihood that he had advanced Parkinson's disease, which perhaps deprived him of some mental acuity and flexibility. Still, it would be unwise to make too much of his declining health as a key factor in his decision-making. In crisis situations, people tend to revert to what they know how to do, what has been done in the past. And here, too, Hitler's knowledge of history played its part. Until the very end of the Great War, his first war, German forces had virtually always mastered and resolved crises and restored the situation when military and political leaders recovered their nerve and stood firm. Now that he, Adolf Hitler, combined both offices in his person, it seemed a doubly important lesson for him to embrace. Further comparison with the earlier war is intriguing as well. During the second half of 1918, General Ludendorff refused to retreat to the more defensible Hindenburg line, was unwilling to give up territory, and envisaged a stubborn foot-by-foot defense. Reverses on the Western Front eventually forced a retreat, which caused Ludendorff to become nervous and agitated, lose self-control, blame those around him, and immerse himself in detail. A pattern of behavior similar to that of Hitler in 1944-45. From mid-1943 at the latest, Hitler also knew that victory of any sort was unlikely. If not yet this early, then certainly following the failure in Normandy, historians usually locate his descent into irrationality, arguing that he fought on senselessly. But from his perspective, was it in fact senseless? With whom was he going to negotiate? Could he have negotiated peace and survived? Not in power, but physically. If his regime was going to be destroyed and he was going to die in any case, why not a Heldentod, hero's death, in a struggle to the finish? Driven by his resolve to prevent and expunge the humiliation of 1918, he came to believe that an apocalypse was preferable to any effort at negotiating a way out, that a heroic death had a redemptive quality to it, that the courage to fight to the end, to the death, without hope of victory or even survival, laid the basis for national regeneration. In this sense, even his suicide could be seen as a form of revenge. His potent sense of threatened national identity stiffened and prolonged German resistance as well, to the point that there seemed among many almost a perverse pride in their ability to take punishment and stay standing. This was a lasting response and rebuke to the failure of 1918. To the end, though, beneath this apocalypticism, Hitler remained insightful on the larger political issues. One cannot, however, make a disjuncture between the political leadership and the purposes of politics. One cannot admire political skill independently of the aims of policy. To a great extent, Hitler willed his life. From obscure artist to unknown soldier, to rabble-rousing politician, to Führer, and then, ultimately, to Feldherr. But his will could not overturn physical reality. Germany did not possess the material means or power to attain Lebensraum or overturn the outcome of the First World War. In his efforts to reverse history, to set things right, though, Hitler became perhaps the most extraordinary figure of the 20th century. The Second World War, the worst conflict in human history, was inconceivable and remains inexplicable without him. 1. Clausewitz, Hitler, and Absolute War. Sweating profusely from nervousness and clearly uncomfortable in a dark blue suit, late on the evening of 1 February 1933, Adolf Hitler addressed the German people by radio for the first time as Reich Chancellor. Uncharacteristically hesitant and speaking in a flat monotone, Hitler denounced the Marxist-induced spiritual, political, and cultural nihilism of the past 14 years that had brought Germany to ruin. The task ahead, he stressed, was difficult, with the immediate goal the elimination of unemployment. In foreign policy, the new regime, the Chancellor emphasized, regarded its crucial mission as safeguarding the rights of existence of the German people, although he was quick to emphasize that the key to this national resurgence was overcoming internal class divisions and the creation of a unified national community, Volksgemeinschaft, not military force. Fully aware of Germany's feeble international position, Hitler posed as a man of peace, stressing his desire for a disarmed, peaceful world. If his initial appearance as Reich Chancellor was notable primarily for its banality, a few days later Hitler faced a much more formidable challenge. While offering the upstart corporal an opportunity to stabilize Germany's perilous domestic situation, President Paul von Hindenburg nonetheless gave a clear signal that he intended to keep the Reichswehr out of his direct control. General Werner von Blomberg had been named defense minister by the aged Field Marshal a few days before Hitler's appointment, and the general now called together the leading figures in the military for a first meeting with the ambitious new political leader. On the evening of 3 February, accompanied only by his personal adjutant, Friedrich Brückner, Hitler arrived at the home of Army Chief General Kurt Freiherr von Hammerstein-Eckwart, where 24 top Army and Navy commanders in the Reichswehr had gathered, ostensibly to mark the 60th birthday of Foreign Minister Konstantin von Neurath. If not exactly a hostile gathering, it certainly represented a more skeptical audience than the one Hitler had addressed over the airwaves 2 days before. Although those present engaged in pleasant small talk during dinner, the overall mood turned noticeably cool and reserved as Hitler began his presentation. It had, in fact, the look of a job interview, as both Hitler and his audience sought to feel each other out, to get a sense of their respective aims and intentions. Although Blomberg and his deputy, Colonel Walter von Reichenau, were both known Nazi sympathizers who wanted to bring the army closer to the Nazi party, the new defense minister's top priorities were to ensure that the Reichswehr maintain its political neutrality and not be drawn into any possible domestic political strife. Since Blomberg believed that the new government provided the basis for national and military renewal, he was also seeking to arrive at some suitable division of labor in the task of rebuilding German power. For his part, Hitler clearly sought to curry favor with the military leaders. He intended as well to outline his ambitious plans for the future, possibly to elicit support, but perhaps also to gauge opposition. Both during the dinner conversation and in his talk, the new chancellor succeeded to a considerable extent in allaying the most pressing misgivings of his listeners. In presenting himself as a humble corporal from the World War, for whom it was almost a dream to be addressing the assembled generals and admirals, Hitler played astutely on the prejudices and self-perceptions of the officer caste. There then followed a typical, for him, recitation of the difficulties facing Germany, foremost among them the danger posed by Bolshevism and the need to eradicate Marxist influences in Germany. More importantly for the assembled military leaders, though, Hitler stressed that this was a task for the political leadership. "I have created my own weapons for the inner struggle," he noted, none too subtly. "The army is only for foreign political conflicts." In an instant, Hitler had reassured the officers that the military would not be dragged into internal conflicts, but could concentrate on rearmament. Uprooting Marxism and educating German youth once again with the will to fight would, he thought, take about 8 years. By that time as well, the army would be capable of supporting an active foreign policy. Hitler also made it clear to those present that his vision of military expansion had little to do with the disarmament discussions then taking place in Geneva. Over the past 14 years, Reichswehr leaders had proposed endless expedients to overcome the crippling weakness imposed on Germany by the Treaty of Versailles. Despite their efforts, Germany remained vulnerable to invasion not only from France, but from Poland and Czechoslovakia as well. Ultimately, the generals came to understand, no strategy, however clever, could turn weakness into strength. For that, they needed more arms and more soldiers. In this connection, Hitler's observations could not fail to appeal to them. In order to achieve the Lebensraum on which Germany's existence depended, he stressed, the rapid buildup of the armed forces, the most important institution of the state, was vital. To that end, conscription must be reintroduced and the army strengthened. Rebuilding the army, Hitler observed, was not without risk, as he raised the possibility of a French preventive strike. "We will see what kind of statesmen they have," he remarked. "If they do have any perceptive leaders, they will not allow us any time, but will attack us, presumably with their eastern satellites." Hitler also left little doubt that this new power would be used for the conquest of living space in the east. But, he stressed, in a remark pregnant with future significance, "a Germanization of the population of the annexed or conquered territories is not possible. One can only Germanize soil." Given his still insecure relationship with the military, revealing the full extent of his ambitions in the East was a rather risky move, one he must have thought necessary in order to gauge the mood of the officers present. In the event, few seemed to have comprehended fully the implications of this statement, or they simply dismissed it as naive ranting. In closing, Hitler again made it clear that he envisioned a cooperative relationship with the military. "We will stand on the side of the army," he emphasized, "and work for the army. The glorious German army, in the same spirit that ruled it during the heroic time of the World War, will freely carry out its tasks." Then, as if to remind the assembled officers that he and they shared a common aim and a unique historic moment, he closed, "You will not again find a man who will work with his entire strength for his goal, the salvation of Germany, as I will. And if you say to me, 'The attainment of the goal depends on you,' I will reply, 'Good. Take advantage of my life.'" Hitler's aim, facilitated by Blomberg, had clearly been to win over doubting generals and ensure army support for his government. Hitler had long courted Reichswehr leaders, but often had an uneasy relationship with the aristocratic generals, many of whom could barely disguise their contempt for the upstart corporal from the wrong social class. Still, despite a few dismissive comments from his audience, none opposed Hitler's ideas, and some embraced them wholeheartedly. While his remarks were generally deemed very logical and good in theory, most supported his immediate vision of a rebuilt army. Despite some reservations, primarily from Werner von Fritsch and Friedrich Fromm, who grumbled about his limitless intentions, Hitler largely succeeded in his task. This was hardly surprising, since he held out the prospect of restoring army strength, removing it from internal political restraint, and establishing the armed forces as the key pillar of a restored German nation. For a brief moment, in fact, military leaders seemed to be in the ascendancy, with an apparently subordinate National Socialist government ready to provide the financial, material, and personnel resources needed to rebuild the army. Blomberg's deputy, Reichenau, an ambitious Nazi sympathizer, went so far as to claim that never before in German history had the military and the state been so identical. In agreeing to provide resources for restoring the army, though, Hitler had ensured that the same Reichswehr that had opposed his coup attempt in November 1923 would now be working with him 10 years later. A minor curiosity at the time, perhaps, but an irony that the self-satisfied generals failed adequately to ponder. Hitler's speech on 3 February 1933 not only initiated a partnership between the Chancellor and the army, but also marked the beginning of the latter's active complicity in his policy. This episode also showed that for all of his authority within the Nazi Party, and for all of the talk of his potential role as Führer, Hitler still faced a challenging situation in defining his relationship with the generals and in asserting his dominance and the primacy of his ideas. Thus, although the goals of Hitler and the military leadership overlapped to a considerable degree, from the beginning there also existed a fundamental divergence about the nature and timing of any future war, a disagreement perhaps masked by the seeming triumph of the general's enhanced status in early 1933. While Hitler willingly provided the resources necessary.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?